I'm George Lavender, and you're listening to Making Contact.
Making contact.
It's incredibly unlikely that using a bombing campaign against Islamic State will end well.
More than a decade after the start of the Second Gulf War, the United States has embarked on a bombing campaign targeting Islamic State forces inside Iraq and Syria. It's the third US military action inside Iraq in as many decades. But the reasons for the new war keep shifting, from protecting ethnic and religious minorities to preventing terrorist attacks on the US. As independent producer Rhys Ehrlich reports from northern Iraq, this latest conflict and the future of the region is tightly connected to the oil industry and international politics.
Fawzia Ali was forced to flee an attack by the Islamic State in the final days of her pregnancy. She and 9 Yazidi family members were given the choice of converting to Islam or leaving their village north of Mosul. She says IS has targeted Yazidis for their religious beliefs and forced them to leave without cars, valuables, or even spare clothes.
The Islamic State attacked our village and killed people, even children. They took some of the women with them. We were afraid for our lives and left.
Her family are Kurdish Yazidis, whose religion combines elements of Zoroastrianism and Shia Islam. IS considers them devil worshippers. Aywa Majdal, who lived in the same village as Ali, says IS engages in ethnic cleansing, killing some and forcing others to flee.
They said they are creating an Islamic caliphate. Only Muslims have the right to live here. No Jews, no Christians, no Yazidi. They told us they would kill all Yazidi people. They will eliminate the Yazidi religion. We faced a possible massacre. Even the Yazidi who converted to Islam to save their lives were later killed.
Just then, a border guard comes over to warn us of a possible sniper in the area.
Careful of snipers.
Turns out there's no sniper this time. Within a few days of this interview, the refugee crisis ebbed, but the U.S. bombing campaign intensified. Antonio Yuhas, an oil analyst and critic of U.S. policy, says the U.S. bombing is merely the upper reaches of a slippery slope to yet another disastrous Iraq war.
It's incredibly unlikely that using a bombing campaign against Islamic State will end well. If you start a U.S. military engagement or continue it in Iraq and Syria, particularly the Iraqis will only see it as a continuation of what has taken place before. And what has taken place before created the failed state that now exists in Iraq, created the incredibly heightened tensions between religious and ethnic groups, and helped create the sort of hate-filled cesspool in which Islamic State was born.
The end goal for the Obama administration, says Yuhas, is exercising political and economic power in the region.
Western oil companies have a lot of interest in Kurdistan. Those that aren't actively producing there yet have contracts to explore for oil, and they want to have access there.
Okay. We're getting in the car and headed to the oil fields. To understand more about the latest U.S. war, I visit the city of Kirkuk in northern Iraq. Just outside of town are the oldest oil fields in the Arab world. Until recently, Kirkuk was nominally controlled by the Baghdad government. It's now ruled by Kurds. As we listen to the radio news broadcast, local photographer Chinar Rojbani agrees to show me Kirkuk's number one attraction, its oil fields. The British pumped oil here starting in 1927. Rojbani explains that a joint British, French, and American oil corporation exploited the region's wealth and made sure pro-oil, pro-British governments ruled Iraq for decades. Rojbani's history lesson suddenly ends as trucks pass by and we see a huge flame shooting skyward.
That's the oil company of Kirkuk. It's a well-flaring natural gas. It sends a flame high into the sky every day, but now the oil fields are closed.
Rojbani explains that IS sabotaged the oil pipelines, and since March, a large majority of the Kirkuk fields have been shut. Then, much to my surprise, he begins to sing. The song lyrics lament how the oil of Kirkuk causes the people to suffer. Kirkuk is full of oil riches, goes the song, but the oil only benefits foreigners. I ask Roshbiani about this curse of oil.
Our city is rich in oil, and it's the source of our misery. Foreign countries, including the United States of America, want to control this oil. Kirkuk residents over the past 100 years haven't had any security or stability. We continuously suffer from war and insecurity because of conflicts arising from efforts to obtain this oil. Sometimes we wish that the oil would just dry up so we could be rid of our troubles.
Foreign oil companies aren't the only source of instability. Iraq's Kurdish regional government has long claimed Kirkuk as its capital. When IS attacked the Iraqi army earlier this year, the Peshmerga took over Kirkuk and shows no signs of returning it to the central Iraqi government. The one oil field still operating ships 25,000 barrels per day north to a Kurdish pipeline and on to Turkey. We start our return to the city of Erbil. Here, along the highway, the lights of Kirkuk fade, and an hour later, the city looms in the distance. Unlike the residents in Kirkuk, many Kurds here welcome oil development. Over 50 multinational corporations compete to pump oil in what has become the Wild West of Kurdistan. In an old photo, Richard Nobb in full camouflage uniform stands next to Masoud Barzani, now the president of Iraqi Kurdistan. In the early 1990s, U.S. Army Colonel Nobb served in Kurdistan during the Gulf War. He and other former officers, including two generals, later got jobs in the oil industry and returned to Erbil. They know nothing about oil exploration, but they know the Kurdish leadership well, an arrangement that was to become mutually beneficial.
I do government relations, and I'm kind of an advisor. I'm actually an old fart that's been around a while. I tell them some things, but...
Now, were you able to make use of the contacts you had made back in the day when you came here as a businessman?
Of course, yeah. I knew them all. They knew me.
Nobb says he and his oil company cohorts want to shift U.S. policy to be more favorable to Kurdistan.
We wanted, quite frankly, to develop American business interests here that would trump what we all still believe is bad U.S. policy.
And those business interests include huge oil company profits. Kurdistan sits on an estimated 45 billion barrels of oil, the ninth largest oil reserves in the world, according to Kurdish officials. It also has some 6 trillion cubic meters of natural gas. Long term, the regional government hopes to replace Russia as a major supplier of oil and gas to Europe, which could shift the strategic balance of power between the U.S., Europe, and Russia. Oil analyst Juhas says ever since the U.S. occupation of Iraq began in 2003, there's been controversy over who owns the Kurdish region's oil.
The fact that the central Iraqi government claims that it owns the oil in Kurdistan and the Kurds do not have the legal authority to draw contracts has kept a number of Western oil companies from actually working in Iraq. So they're present, I mean, in Kurdistan, they're present, but most of them aren't actually engaged in production yet. They're sort of hedging their bets, assuming that things are going to get worked out between the central government and Kurdistan.
In recent years, however, Kurdish officials defied Baghdad, signed contracts with Western oil companies, developed their own oil fields, and set truckloads of crude for sale to Turkey and Iran, thus breaking U.S. economic sanctions against Iran. On a previous trip, I visited Taktak, the Kurdish region's largest oil field. Kemal Afaraç, assistant district manager at Taktak, explains how his men put oil in trucks.
We will watch how the tankers are being loaded. We will have the tanker coming first to the weighbridge and then going under the loading arms and the loading personnel. will be loading the crude oil into the tankers.
An old, dented truck drives up, makes a U-turn on a gravel road, and then pulls up to an oil depot with long, flexible pipes called loading arms. Workers sweat in the 110-degree desert heat as they unscrew a lid on top of a truck and insert the loading arms. They flip a switch, and the oil starts pumping. Tok Tok truckers worked hard but couldn't export much oil. Pipelines carry a lot more and are safer. In December 2013, the Kurdish regional government opened an oil pipeline to Turkey. It currently exports about 120,000 barrels a day, an amount which would have taken a week by truck. Kurdistan is competing fiercely with Baghdad to attract international oil corporations, says Juhas, offering very sweet deals to companies interested in its sweet crude.
The Kurds sought very aggressively to gain the support of the West by moving even further ahead than the central Iraqi government in passing laws that basically granted all that the Western oil companies could ever want and in getting access to Kurdish oil.
The Kurdish regional government lured international oil corporations by signing production sharing agreements. Oil companies front the money for exploration, and if the oil gushes, they receive about 18% ownership.
With production sharing agreements, international oil companies can book the reserves as their own, which is crucial. The bottom line, how it's valued as a company, is how much reserves it has, and most importantly, its reserve ratio. So basically, how much it's producing each day versus what it has on reserve.
The oil ministry in Baghdad, on the other hand, only signs service agreements under which the oil companies receive a fee for every barrel produced. The multinationals were never happy with those agreements because of the relatively low profit margin. Oil executive Nob agrees that oil corporations prefer production sharing agreements, or PSAs, even though they involve more risk.
The service contract, you just get a percentage of what's produced, period. For the other companies, if you have a discovery, you can book the discovery on your books and you get a share of the profits. And it's advantageous to the host country, but you get good money out of it if you hit.
I asked Nob for his reaction to those Kurds who say oil companies exploit the country for their own profit.
Then I always tell the Kurds, I said, you know, they make noise about the exploitation of the country, but it takes a lot of money. I didn't know this before, to make money in oil. And there's a tremendous investment by the Peros and by other companies here to put in the ground. If they get a dry hole, they're out. If they hit, it's a win for the Kurds too, because the Kurds get approximately 80% of what's discovered. The companies get, you know, 20% or less. So it's a really, you know, for the Kurds, I say, hey, don't, this is a good deal for you. This is about your future that we're investing in.
But if the oil field is jointly developed by a number of companies, the Kurdish ownership could drop to 25% or less. The regional government also provides massive tax breaks. Foreign companies investing in the Kurdish region, including oil corporations, pay no taxes for the first 10 years of operation and are able to import items used in business without customs taxes, terms that Nob calls very generous. As a result, over the last few years, major U.S. companies opened offices in Erbil.
Exxon walked away from theirs down there to come up here because you have a lot more potential gain on the upside.
But oil company plans were scrambled when Islamic State attacked northern Iraq in June 2014. By August, many companies had evacuated staff, fearing an IS assault on Kurdistan and general instability in the region. Juhas says Western oil companies also worry about a newly expanded and independent Kurdistan.
And a stable country with a friendly government where they have access to oil is what the companies want. A unified Iraq has a better potential to be stable than Kurdistan fighting against the central Iraqi government for independence, which is not going to be simple and will certainly be bloody and will certainly be drawn out.
But Kurdish officials say that once IS is expelled from Kurdish areas, independence is back on the table. Hemen Harami, a leader of the ruling Kurdish Democratic Party, says Kurds have waited for years to gain independence.
Kurdish independence and self-determination right is our God-given natural right. We are not Arabs, we are not Turks, we are just another nation. We cannot wait another 10 years to see how Baghdad is going. We are working on the political process in Baghdad, but with all of these efforts also, we are not stepping back from the efforts that we have for the practicing the self-determination rights.
The push for independence will impact the international oil companies. Yuha says they are, above all, pragmatic.
The companies also just want access. So if the Kurds want independence, you know, and they're never going to agree with the central Iraqi government, and there's never going to be peace between the two countries, and the companies will never be able to figure out where it's safe to operate, then they'll go for independence. For them, it's not about ideology, it's about access.
You're listening to Making Contact. For more information about this show, go to radioproject.org. That's also where you can download past shows or make a difference by supporting our work. Join the conversation on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. We now return to our special documentary, Islamic State, Kurdistan, and the New US War in Iraq, produced by Reese Ehrlich.
Erbil's open-air marketplace is bustling and full of patriotism. This song playing on the radio praises the prowess of the Peshmerga, the Kurdish militia. But the IS offensive in August 2014 shook up the population, particularly when IS came within 30 miles of the Kurdish capital of Erbil. Hundreds rushed to take up arms against IS, while thousands took part in rallies, like this one, held by the Kurdistan Democratic Party. Shirin Jabbar attends the rally to show her support for the government and Peshmerga.
We are here to tell the world that Kurdistan is not a threat to any country. We want peace. We organize this civilian demonstration. We will protect ourselves from foreign invasion by any means necessary.
She acknowledges that the current crisis has delayed plans for Kurdish independence. But she, like most Kurds, says they will have a state in the near future. Kurds were promised their own country after World War I, but imperial powers kept them divided in four neighboring countries. She says independence didn't seem possible until recently.
In order to achieve our dream of independence, we will fight and we give our blood. Independence is the hope and expectation of all Kurds. Many countries have less than 100,000 residents. The Kurdish nation in Iraq has more than 8 million. So why don't we have the right to our own state?
To understand more about the prospects for Kurdish independence, I take a car ride with Saman Shali. He's a political commentator, business consultant, and former candidate for parliament. He explains that Iraqi Kurdistan is split between two major political parties, each of which controls territory and funds services normally done by a government, including police and military Peshmerga units. Shali says both parties siphon money from the government in massive corruption schemes.
Corruption, yes. It was, and still like every other new, say, open up democracy or having from nothing, you have nothing, suddenly you have billions of dollars, corruption started. But this corruption is coming down.
Well, there's some debate as to whether corruption is decreasing or just getting more sophisticated. Shali explains that contractors overcharge on government projects, party leaders skim money off the top, as do crony subcontractors who don't do any work but are loyal to that political party.
The contracts from the government, they overprice it. The top guy, they take the cream, the second take another level and level until came to the actual level. Then the guy, he work on
it. So if you're going to build a new building, you...
A government building.
A government building.
Yes.
You overprice it and you keep the difference for yourself.
Yeah, that's what they do. Yeah. Schools, hospitals, you know, all that. Roads, bridges.
And government largesse to political parties is enshrined in law. All the political parties receive government subsidies amounting to $575,000 per year per member of parliament. Oil company executive Nob concedes corruption is an institutional problem.
Parties do sort of many civil service functions. You know, they hire and fire people, governors and police and Pesh. And there is corruption. Everybody knows it. I mean, the people that complain the loudest are those who don't get a share of the corruption.
But Nob claims Kurdish corruption is not the same as that found in the rest of Iraq.
The corruption here, you'll see all this development is possible because the money comes back, you know, and invests in hotels and restaurants, and that's what's causing this thing to boom. Whereas in other places, Baghdad, the money is collected and goes out to Switzerland or wherever. So there's better corruption and bad corruption. Yeah. But yeah, they're working on it. They're aware of it. They don't need me to tell them that.
Even if that is true, Kurdish-style corruption has very practical consequences for the government and military. Corrupt officials skim money rather than distribute it to the Peshmerga. Fighters have to buy their own light arms and ammunition. Shali says the Peshmerga lacks modern weapons, flak vests, and even helmets.
When you go to the front line, as you see it in the TV, day and night you see them, they have nothing.
And says Shali, soldiers are loyal to the Peshmerga of their political party, not to a national army.
These two parties, which they have different Peshmerga under there, we try to unite these forces. And that steps to unite. It's been working, but they are never succeeded to really to unite them. What the Kurdish people want, to build an army, real army, belong to the people, not belong to any political party. That's a huge task. And they promised to do that, but I know it is very difficult.
Kurds were shocked to see their Peshmerga retreat in the face of an IS offensive in the summer of 2014. Some top Kurdish leaders had reached a secret non-aggression agreement with Sunni tribal chiefs aligned with the IS. The Peshmerga agreed not to attack the IS and vice versa. But then IS reneged on the deal.
It was alarming to the Kurds where we are vulnerable and where our strength. And this fight show that the Kurds need better equipped, better army, better forces to be trained and to be ready when you establish yourself. This brings the nation together. This first time in the history of the Kurds, I mean in all the four parts of Kurdistan, Turkey, Iran, Iraq, Syria.
We're now back in Kirkuk, about an hour south of Erbil, with the singing photographer. The Islamic State fighters control areas only 30 miles out of town. So far, the Peshmerga have kept them away from the city. But Kirkuk is a city torn by internal conflict. Remember, until recently, Kirkuk was nominally under Baghdad's control. The Peshmerga only took power in July. Our first stop is the well-fortified office of Kirkuk's governor, Najm al-Din Karim. He says the Peshmerga, unsupported by Baghdad, acted to protect the city from IS attack. He says that initially the local Iraqi army commander pretended that his troops would defend the city.
We had a meeting here with the division commander, and he said, yeah, he's ready for them and all that, but by 4 in the afternoon, they were all gone. And by the next morning, everything was finished. He came here, and we helped him to go back to Baghdad. Over the next few days, we had additional reinforcements from Kurdistan region. Total, we have anywhere between 15 and 17,000.
While the Kurds see the takeover of Kirkuk as a defensive measure against IS, other Kirkuk residents see it as a power grab. Many Christians, ethnic Arabs, and Turkmen say the Peshmerga has permanently occupied their city and plans to annex it into an independent Kurdistan. The Turkmen, people with historic ties to Turkey, make up about 10% of Iraq's population, and many live in Kirkuk. Ali Mehdi Sadiq, a leader of the Iraqi Turkmen Front and member of the Kirkuk City Council, explains his objections to Kurdish rule.
Since the U.S. occupation of Iraq, we've been living with Kurds having a lot of political power. We've suffered a lot from Kurdish management of Kirkuk city.
Kurdish leaders say they'll hold a referendum in Kirkuk and other disputed areas to determine if the majority want to join Kurdistan. Once the borders of Kurdistan are fixed, they plan to hold a second vote for or against independence. Mehdi says many Kirkuk residents would reject joining Kurdistan.
More of people don't want to go to Kurdistan. There are Kurdish people also don't want, they want Kirkuk region. Mm-hmm. Arab, all the Arab don't want.
There's a plan for a referendum, as you know.
No, Barzani. I don't think there is a referendum take place now in Iraq.
In 6 months?
No, I don't think so. I don't think.
But Kurds say Kirkuk is the historic capital of Kurdistan. Governor Karim argues that Kirkuk would vote to become part of Kurdistan because of the large number of Kurds living here.
And I think overwhelming majority of the Kurds will vote for it. But if we just go for a referendum like this before any understanding between us, I think it will be very split and divisive way to do it. And I think Kirkuk will not benefit from it this way. My feeling is that the different communities in Kirkuk has to have some understanding. What is Kirkuk's situation in the event that a vote is taken and decides to go to Kurdistan region? Kirkuk should have a special status in that case.
Such generalities trouble Turkmen leader Mehdi. Switching to English, he says the Kurds make lots of historic arguments about Kirkuk being their land, but in reality, he says, referring to the two major Kurdish parties, it's all about oil.
Now the KDP want to control the oil in Kirkuk, and the PUK want to control all Kirkuk. It is a big problem, but I don't think they can't control the oil in Kirkuk without agreement or dialogue.
Key to Kurdish independence is control of the Kirkuk oil field, period.
Oil analyst Antonia Juhas says the Kurds need Kirkuk oil to survive.
The Kurds are already incredibly struggling economically. They've already sold their oil on deals that is incredibly unbeneficial to them. They need all that oil or they can't have independence. And I think my guess is they care very little about the concerns of minority groups and that they need that oil. The fact that the fight against Islamic State has for the first time put the Kirkuk field under the control of the Peshmerga means they're not going to give it up.
When the U.S. began bombing northern Iraq in August, the Obama administration said it was stopping the massacre of Yazidis, like those here in the Kurdish region. But the Yazidi crisis ended, and the bombing intensified. Now the U.S. and its allies are bombing insurgent targets in Syria. The U.S. has started another war in the Middle East, costing an estimated $10 million per day, and it appears unlikely to end anytime soon.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. You've been listening to Islamic State, Kurdistan, and the New U.S. War in Iraq, written and produced by Rhys Ehrlich. His most recent book is Inside Syria, the backstory of their civil war and what the world can expect, published by Prometheus Books, with a foreword by Noam Chomsky. Special thanks to journalist Rodi Hessen in Erbil. Again, you can find out more information about this program and others at radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm George Lavender. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.